Welcome to HIPAA Bytes. In this podcast, I'll be providing practical commentary on conducting a risk assessment under HIPAA's breach notification rule. The final HIPAA omnibus rule modified the definition of breach such that any impermissible use or disclosure of protected health information is presumed to be a breach requiring notification, unless one of the very limited statutory exceptions to the definition of breach applies, or the covered entity or business associate demonstrates, through a risk assessment, that there is a low probability that the protected health information has been compromised. Previously, in the interim final rule for breach notification, there was no such presumption, and a covered entity was only required to notify an affected individual of a breach if there was a significant risk of financial, reputational, or other harm to the individual. In the final HIPAA omnibus rule, HHS enumerated four factors that must be included in any risk assessment that demonstrates that there is a low probability that the protected health information has been compromised. These factors are derived from the factors that were listed in the interim final rule for breach notification. Although HHS has indicated that it will issue guidance for covered entities and business associates performing risk assessments, we all know that breaches will happen in the interim. So I'm going to go out on a limb a bit on this podcast and provide what I hope are practical suggestions for lines of inquiry to pursue with respect to each of the HHS-defined risk factors when conducting a risk assessment. The first factor that must be considered in any risk assessment is the nature and extent of the protected health information that was involved, including the types of identifiers and the likelihood of re-identification. I'll address the nature of the protected health information first. This means, among other things, that an entity, whether a covered entity or a business associate, that believes it may have suffered a breach, should consider whether the protected health information includes any information that enjoys additional protection under state and federal law, such as mental health diagnoses, HIV status, and information about treatment for substance abuse. For good reasons, this type of information is often referred to as sensitive information. A breach involving sensitive information increases the likelihood of reputational harm to an individual, and due to its adverse effect on the individual, is more likely to result in the protected health information being compromised. Also consider whether the protected health information includes names, social security numbers, credit card numbers, and other unique identifiers that increase the risk of harm to individuals from identity theft or financial fraud. If the information has few, if any, identifiers, examine how difficult it would be to re-identify an individual based on the information. For example, if the information consists of account numbers and balances without names or other identifiers, review the extent to which it would be possible for re-identification to occur without access to the covered entity's patient account system and the effectiveness of any controls in place to protect against unauthorized access to that system. In addition to the type of protected health information, the first factor in the risk assessment requires consideration of the extent of the protected health information. In this regard, keep in mind that apart from social security numbers and sensitive information, such as we have discussed, it is often very difficult to characterize particular types of protected health information as having low, moderate, or high probability of being compromised simply based on the type of protected health information, because information sensitivity to compromise is partly contextual. For example, a birth date in one context, such as on a list of birth dates for patients scheduled to attend a flu vaccination clinic, will be less sensitive to compromise than in another context, such as a list of birth dates with zip codes and detailed health status information that, while it does not include sensitive information, may be individually identifiable and sufficiently detailed to lead to reputational or other harm and compromise of the information. The second factor that must be considered in any risk assessment is the unauthorized person or entity who used the information or to whom it was disclosed. In assessing this factor, consider whether the unauthorized person was a covered entity or business associate who has obligations to protect the privacy or security of similar information under HIPAA. Alternatively, consider whether the unauthorized person or entity has some other legal obligation to protect individuals' privacy, such as a bank that must protect the privacy of individuals' financial information pursuant to the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. It is also useful to consider whether the unauthorized person simultaneously engaged in any criminal conduct, malfeasance, or other unauthorized act when he or she used or received the information, and whether he or she is likely to know the value of the information and use it or try to sell it to others. Such persons are more likely to increase the probability that the protected health information has been compromised insofar as they may use the information to further their own interests. If the information has few, if any, identifiers, consider whether the unauthorized person might have access to other information, including publicly available information, that could be used to re-identify the information, and whether it is likely that the unauthorized person has the expertise required to re-identify the information, or if expertise is even required to do that. Lastly, consider whether there might be more than one unauthorized recipient of the protected health information and assess the risk for each one or class of similarly situated unauthorized recipients. The third factor that must be considered in any risk assessment is whether the protected health information was actually acquired or viewed. If the protected health information is later retrieved, perhaps it can be demonstrated that the information was never accessed. Examples of this circumstance might include a box of medical records that goes missing during a move but later turns up, and upon review of the chain of custody and examination of the box, it can be verified that it was never unsealed. Or forensic analysis of a stolen laptop that was recovered demonstrates that the protected health information on the laptop was never accessed, viewed, transmitted, or copied. The fourth and final factor that must be considered in any risk assessment is the extent to which the risk to the protected health information has been mitigated. In the event the unauthorized person returned the protected health information and provided assurances that he or she would protect the confidentiality of the information, the risk that the information was compromised would be reduced. Alternatively, consider the extent to which other controls are in place, such as monitoring to protect and prevent protected health information from being compromised. For example, if the protected health information that was impermissibly disclosed was a medical record number, investigate whether other controls are in place at the covered entity, such as requiring presentation of a government-issued identification, to prevent an individual from using that medical record number to commit medical identity theft. As was the case in the interim final rule, covered entities and business associates have the burden of proof to demonstrate that all the notifications that are required due to the breach were provided, or that the impermissible use or disclosure of protected health information was not a breach. Therefore, risk assessments should be documented and retained in accordance with the HIPAA regulations. Lastly, covered entities and business associates may opt to provide the required notice without performing a risk assessment, which may be preferable in instances where, given the circumstances, it's highly unlikely that there is a low probability that protected health information has been compromised. I hope this podcast has been helpful. If there are additional issues you would like to see addressed here on HIPAA Bytes, please feel free to contact me. Thank you for listening.